Hello, Denim Heads, and welcome to the 29th Hangout with the Sons of Selvage, a podcast where a group of friends get together to talk about denim and related interests. This episode, we've got a special guest episode. Mike from Red Rabbit Trading Co. is going to be with us today. Maybe we'll do a quick round of introductions with folks on the call, and then we'll jump right into the interview with Mike. So I'm David, and today I'm wearing a Belgian linen Western from Nine Lives brand, and some Pure Blue Japan regular straight jeans that are, I guess, a broken twill and kind of a lighter dye, which is kind of cool color-wise. So I'll be keen to see how they fade. Over you to Ilya.
So Ilya here. I'm wearing a Buzz Rickson sweatshirt and some Black Horse Lane jeans. How about yourself, Tom?
I'm going to be honest. Wearing a velvet t-shirt and no trousers because I'm quickly assembling my PC where it has been disassembled. So, but what I'll say instead is I'm wearing my United overalls jeans. There you go.
Yeah, I was going to say, what virtual jeans would you be wearing if you're actually being decent?
Sorry, Mike.
Cool. And over to you, Mike.
Hey, I'm Mike French from Red Rabbit Trading Co. and I have just a plain black t-shirt on. So,
Cool. All right. So maybe to kick things off, Mike, if you could maybe tell us a little bit about Red Rabbit Trading Co. So like, what's the brand, kind of how'd you get it started, and maybe just kind of an introduction to your brand.
Yeah, definitely. It's always one of those things, like it may not be that romantic coming from me, but probably about 8 or 10 years ago, the kind of general story is that I really wanted some Mexican biker rings at the time. And being about 10 years ago, the prices on them were crazy. They were all over the place also, but in doing research on the jewelry and then like how to make that jewelry, I found that it was relatively the same price of two rings as it would be to buy all the things to actually make the rings. So I thought I'd just forgo buying the actual pieces and buy all of the materials to actually make the pieces. So in just like doing online deep dives on the imagery of that jewelry and kind of that time period also, I came across like the early Fred Harvey Southwest style jewelry. And I was like really taken aback because for me, when I thought of like Southwest and like turquoise jewelry, it was very like bohemian 60s, 70s kind of Jim Morrison kind of vibe. And like, I was just not into that imagery. So when I found the earlier stuff, I was just like super intrigued. So I was living there and just doing a bunch of research on the jewelry imagery. I just kind of thought that I'd give it a shot to like make it also, you know, picking up vintage, repairing it, just kind of checking it out and studying it. And then just kind of started making it from there. Also, like where I was, it was just kind of a black hole as far as anything like that. But then also it's just kind of like a price point thing, you know, as you get into things, you don't know if you want to spend, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars on one piece that you may not be into. So it was kind of, you know, like, I'll just see if I can make this. And at the time I had retired from my other job. So I kind of took like a year off and just kind of like taught myself how to do that and knife making and soap making, and jewelry is just kind of what stuck. And then it's kind of just been going with it ever since then. So.
And what kind of kit did you generally have to pick up to be able to even to make this jewelry? Like, what kind of stuff did you need in general?
Essentially the process was called lost wax casting. I mean, it's how, you know, they were making jewelry in the Roman and Grecian time. So it wasn't really like a kit so much as like trying to like piece together these things. As far as like, you know, you could get away with relatively rudimentary tools so long as you knew the concept. And then it just kind of was trial and error. Lucky enough, my grandparents had some space in their barn and I just kind of like took over a corner and just sat out there and kind of went from there, you know, just a lot of YouTube deep diving and just kind of trial and error for the most part.
That's cool. And when you get into the, like, working with turquoise and onyx, are you having to do like additional steps to prepare the stone to fit with the jewelry you cast, or is that like a whole different process?
Anytime that you throw like a stone in the mix, it's like a whole nother step or handful of steps, you know. I mean, you can buy the stones raw, you know, right out of the ground, and then it's a whole nother thing, the steps to get it to where it's actually able to be set in. Or you can also just buy the stones like pre-cut, ready to go, you know, and it lessens the steps definitely. But I feel like anytime you add a stone into the mix, it changes the aesthetic. It definitely changes the perceived time period that jewelry would fit in also. Because they weren't really setting stones until a certain time period. And so it kind of changes the point of view and the story of the piece, you know, from plain silver to having a stone or any appliques onto the stone or onto the piece also. So not only like aesthetically is it something that you have to work around, but also it's kind of like, well, you know, this, it wouldn't have this stamp with this stone, you know, from across the way, like it's going to look nice, but you're not really going to fool anybody that knows anything about anything kind of thing. And I'm sure you see the same thing a million times over in denim. You know, there's some of those companies that stick super, super true and super rigid. But then, like you mentioned, there's some companies like Nine Lives that are kind of like mashups of things that like, well, it's traditional this, but modern cuts and so on and so forth. And it's kind of one of those things that like works, but it doesn't work in certain respects.
Yeah, it's funny. I laugh a lot about... Oh, go ahead, Ilya, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to ask, where do you stand on that? Do you want things to be like very pure, traditional and authentic? Or are you okay to mix things in a little bit and have your own take on it?
It kind of depends because there's a lot of like blurred lines, you know. I mean, it's especially in the US, it's a type of jewelry that really isn't that old, and there's not like hard lines and stuff like that. So I think there's some gray area, but I try and stick to, you know, at least the loose rules, or at least my perception of the loose rules, just because I think they're in place for aesthetics more so than anything else. You know, it's kind of one of those things you need to know the rules before you can break them kind of thing. So I have a hard time when somebody's just doing wacky shit just to do wacky shit. You know, it's fine and technically it might look good, or I guess it might work technically, but aesthetically, does it work? And I think when, you know, when it comes down to clothes or jewelry, some things like that, you know, the main goal is aesthetic, as opposed to like a lighter or even like a chore coat or like a box or something like that, the number one function, you know, the number one thing is going to be function over aesthetic. So I think it's that dance to where like which is more important, you know. And in certain things, I think, you know, of course, like a painting aesthetically, it has to work as opposed to anything else. So it kind of just depends on, you know, what the goal is for that item, I guess. You know, and then you got to depend on the customer a little bit too. But I mean, more often than not, you know, I think that we have a pretty specific point of view, and we're not scared to say no to somebody's idea if we just don't think it's going to work. So,
do you get quite a lot of people reaching out and asking for weird things for you to do?
Not so much anymore. I mean, in the day we used to when we were first starting and we were first kind of getting our point of view dialed in. I mean, it was also kind of along that time, you know, 8 years ago when, you know, Instagram was really popping off and makers were really popping off and kind of thing. So like we were literally having people send us pages from like our friends that make jewelry, and they're like, hey, can you make this? And we're like, well, why don't you just ask them to do it? And come to find out, it'd be like, well, they didn't like the price they got, or so and so's bookings were too long and stuff like that. And now I feel like we're lucky enough to where like we have, you know, our point of view dialed in to where we don't really have to mess with that so much. Or at least if we do, we kind of take the time and talk to the customer and explain like why we wouldn't do that, or whatever, you know, and hopefully they understand it, or, you know, we just kind of say no. So.
Yeah. And I guess you've also built up quite a bit of a catalog of different products that you've made over that time, so people can reference those things from your own page rather than from somebody else.
Yeah, it's funny. Usually when somebody asks for something, we always say, send us photos from our page. And then if the photos aren't from our page, we're like, are you sure you're even messaging the right person? Like, you'd be surprised how many times that happens. And we're just like, I don't think you want us to do this. This is not our point of view at all. Like, you know, and maybe they're just copying and pasting and just shooting a message out into the ether kind of thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I've kind of always been afraid of custom anything, because it feels like the one or two times I've had something done custom, from like whether it's a shirt or something else, it never quite lives up to my expectations. It's like my mental picture of like what this cool, unique thing is going to be never ends up being what it actually is. And I'm like, shit, I should have just bought the one that the designer thought through and, you know, kind of already figured out. it's that way for a reason.
Yeah. So Lockhart is notoriously bad for their internet connection.
No worries.
So weirdly enough, like, you know, Austin is such a tech hub, and we have a lot of Austinites that live here and work from home and stuff. And literally me and my wife every single day, we're like, how are people working from home? Like, we have a hard time streaming. Like, it's wild.
Yeah, it can't keep the electricity going in a cold front. So I wouldn't trust them for much else.
Yeah, literally the other day they were going around telling people that they'd like everyone to turn their AC to lighten the load on the grid, and we're just like, no.
Oh man. So. Yeah, I remember brownouts in California, so it's definitely a nationwide problem, I think, to some degree.
Yeah, definitely, it's crazy.
Well, I guess maybe kind of talking a bit more about, you know, you mentioned kind of like dialing in, you know, what you have to say and your identity and in sort of your brand. What's the kind of story behind, you know, the Rabbit on the Brain slogan and kind of Red Rabbit Trading Co. as a brand? Like, how do you come up with that?
Well, the Rabbit on the Brain shirt, it's kind of an annoyance for us, honestly. Make a long story short, a designer from Italy came up with that image. And we had it for, I think we had it for 3 or 4 years, and we just did stickers. And so many clients were like, do shirts, do hoodies, do hats, do all this. And we've kind of never really listened. So we had that image for a couple of years, and eventually we were like, okay, you know, people have been bothering us. We should do something with this. So we went crazy, and we did, I'm just looking over at our display, we did two separate t-shirts, multiple colors, and then we did a hooded sweatshirt and a crew neck. So we were like, oh, we've got it covered, multiple colors, the whole nine. And man, we can't give these shirts away. So it was like, oh, no. Literally like our most popular image, like no one cared about. And as far as like the naming it, it's just, that's just the name that came out when we were putting it up online, just going off of what the artist designed. But yeah, that image or that artwork's kind of ended up being like a thorn in our side, because I think we did it about 3 years ago and we still have like full size runs of almost everything. So since then we're just like, yeah, we're not going to listen to anybody ever. We're just going to do what we want. Because, you know, like, especially everybody always wants black t-shirts. Like, I've got enough black t-shirts, so we always try not to do black t-shirts. So it's just one of those things with that image. But as far as like the name of the brand, at the time I had a pet rabbit, like a little mini Rex, one of those kind of like velveteen kind of colors. And he passed away like right around the time we were starting. And there was no like thought or anything. It was just like, oh, like I needed a name to start putting stuff up on Instagram. And, you know, it really was just taking a couple of photos and needing a name as opposed to just putting it under my name. And that was kind of it. There's no big plan behind it or anything.
Yeah, it's cool. The fact that it kind of connects to a personal story is pretty cool though. So it sort of has a, a value and sentiment that, you know, any other name you could have landed on wouldn't have. So I think that's still pretty cool.
Yeah, I don't know how companies normally come up with names.
Or if I understand correctly, folks can come visit your showroom by appointment. What's it like for someone to pop by and kind of check out your workshop, check out your jewelry in person? Like, what's that experience like?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's always one of those things when you're inside of it, it's always hard to, like, you know, like, quantify it. I mean, make a long story short, for us, when we moved to Lockhart, I had visited it once for like 12 hours. We mostly just wanted to get out of the place that we were in. So this house that we got had an attached garage that we converted to, you know, the showroom. So it's kind of like an attached two-car garage that we converted, put a bathroom in. So it's kind of like its own little vortex. But it's kind of trippy because you can't see that it's a quote unquote business from the street. Like when you roll up, it just looks like somebody's house. So you can kind of tell, like, people are pretty apprehensive rolling up, and then, you know, we greet them and then bring them in, and then it's a kind of like a pretty good representation of the brand, and then they kind of like relax a little bit. But when we did this, we were just like, we need a place just for like the brand, like for all of our inventory, for us to take photos, like all of that stuff. We just want to have it separate in one place. And we can just close the door and be done with it. And we're like, oh, we should just let people make appointments and see how it goes. And, you know, like we're half an hour outside of Austin. Like the town's pretty small. Like it's kind of hard to get a hold of us. And, you know, I guess as far as a business model, it's about as terrible as you'd want to make it. But we were like, if people show up, cool. If they don't show up, cool. I mean, it's not like we're paying rent or anything like that. So it's just one of those wild things where we'll go a month and have nobody. But the other day we had a couple from Sweden in here.
That's cool.
And then, you know, we'll have 3 days where we're slammed and it's crazy. And then we'll have like 2 months where there's nothing. So it's just, it's really weird and it's, you know, not the best business model. But we tried to make the space just a very good representation of the brand. You know, it's decorated very, you know, pre-1950s, you know, that kind of like Buck Rogers, Western kind of vibe. A lot of hand-painted signs that we've had done and, you know, just a lot of our own personal stuff from like the Southwest vibe. And just tried to have it be like a very good representation of the brand. So, you know, you're not just kind of coming over to somebody's house sitting in a random garage or bedroom. You're actually like kind of in it, you know. I don't know. The experience seems to be pretty good for people. You know, it's not like they're going to tell me it's terrible to my face or anything, though. So.
It sounds cool, though. I mean, I imagine like driving up and then your garage door comes up and there's like a big giant neon rabbit hidden behind the garage door that's like glowing when you're in the
driveway. Well, it's kind of like that because you drive up and then the garage is on one side and we've got a collection of old bikes and cars and then the house is to the right. So it's like you really cannot see anything at all until you walk in the doors. Like it's super, super hidden. And, you know, we usually go out and bring people in. Oh, you know, come on in. Like, yeah, you know, watch the dog. Like we keep it pretty casual. And then usually once they get in, you kind of see like the reservations that, you know, they're a lot more relaxed. But, you know, you've got to be pretty into the brand or really want to shop if you're going to, you know, make an appointment and then come all the way down here. And there's even been instances where we've messaged people and we're like, you can't have an appointment. We're in London. You know, or, you know, what are you looking for? Yeah, maybe it'd not be the best time for you to come down because we don't have a very good selection of that kind of item right now or your size or whatever else. So we try and just be very straightforward and communicative about it. As far as the showroom, like it's secondary for us because we are, you know, so much online that we try and only offer it if it's going to be like a very good, well-rounded experience. We, you know, we're not just going to be like, oh, come over and there's 6 rings over here for you to look at or something like that. We want to make sure that, you know, when they are going to have that experience, that it's going to be pretty well-rounded. So.
And maybe loop back to London momentarily, but while on the topic, like what's it like for customers to buy from you online? Like sort of how does that work?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, like I said, it kind of goes back to all this kind of being accidental. Like, primarily when we first started, we were just selling on Instagram. You know, it was very like, excuse me, send us a message if you want it, and, you know, please pay friends and family kind of thing. And then we were just copying and pasting addresses. And as we went, we were like, this is just out of control. This is too much to handle as far as like all the communications. And I fought it for a long time because I'm very like old school as far as like tangibility. And my wife was like, we need to have a website. We need to have, this needs to be like a real thing. Because for years it wasn't. It was just, this is what we're doing. And when it stops working out, it stops working out. And there was really no like thought process to like building it up to be anything other than just what we're doing right now. So, I mean, then we built out a website, you know, that's very basic, you know, it's very Squarespace, but it kind of depends. I mean, I guess you kind of get two different experiences. You can either hop on there and buy and you don't have to talk to anybody ever. And then you're going to get an email for confirmation, email when it ships, and you can track it and you don't ever have to talk to anybody. Or I had a young lady order this morning that was like, in her notes section, it said blue turquoise only, absolutely no green. I don't want any green. And then she asked a bunch of questions. And for me, I know it's not the most professional, but I just hopped on and a text message, just texted her, sent her some photos. And I mean, she placed her order this morning and it's probably going to go out in less than 12 hours just because of the expediency with the communication now. So I guess you kind of get almost like whatever kind of experience you want, you know, depending on how much personal interaction you want or you don't want. So
I never knew until just now that turquoise varied in its different colors.
Oh, yeah, it varies all over the place. Like it essentially depends on the mineral content or lack thereof in the host rock or the area around it. And then also copper is a big factor. So it depends on how much copper or lack thereof and then the oxidation of it. But yeah, it ranges a spectrum. Primarily, it's going to be blue or green, but there's even like purples and variations in between there, too. So it's crazy that shit comes out of the ground and, you know, it can vary in color like that.
And I know we talked earlier a bit about kind of like it's a different ball game if you're setting a stone. Just kind of personal style. I mean, do you have a bias towards what you like the look of, whether it's like a turquoise piece, an onyx piece, a just silver alone, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, it depends because I kind of got into this and started appreciating it for the silver work. And I think a lot of people don't really understand the silver work so much because they don't understand the process. So the stone ends up taking center stage and then the silver work is always like supporting actor kind of thing. You know, no matter who you are, you're going to have a hard time holding the candle to Brad Pitt kind of thing. And that's kind of like the stone is always going to be that like moth to a flame kind of moment. But then I'll like, you know, I like could care less about the stone for the most part, especially if it's an old piece or, you know, if I know who made it, then I'm going to like trip out over the silver work. And I'm going to be like, you guys just don't understand how much work this thing is right here, or that like this rounds the edge. So, I mean, it depends. It's all got to be that kind of like, you know, culmination of everything coming together. And, you know, I think just with paintings or songs or anything, there's lesser and there's better. You know, it's the first album kind of thing as opposed to the third album kind of thing. So it really just depends, you know, and it also just depends on how you're feeling that day kind of thing, too. But I would say that for the most part, I would probably not care so much about stone pieces. If I did, it would always be green. Generally, the green, like the more saturated green stones kind of harken to like a certain time period also. So that's kind of something that stays truer to the style of the jewelry that we do. It would be a super saturated green color would have been in that jewelry. So it's kind of just like has to tick all the boxes.
Yeah, that's cool. One thing that was just kind of coming into my mind while you're talking about that is I was thinking about how Freenote, for a lot of their shirts, they'll get kind of like custom pearl snaps designed with like turquoise inlays and stuff. And I can see a cool collaboration there because they've kind of got that sort of Southern California, Southwest kind of vibe going too, where like you guys do some kind of cool jewelry plus clothing collab. That could be kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, there might be something in the works right now.
So. I feel like I should be some kind of like brand PR person or something. Like read the tea leaves.
We've known those guys for years, and I mean, I have to touch base with Matthew about it. But like last year, we started talking about doing something together and stuff. So it's just one of those things, you know, like with being how busy everybody is. You know, when you're running a small brand, you're shipping and PR and all these other things. So it's hard to finally pin down these things that like, oh, we talked about this a year ago. Like, let's get it going again kind of thing. So, but yeah, that's been on the front of our mind. But I mean, we've only been back, we've only been back from London for like a week. So
well, maybe let's jump into that, because I know, I think Ilya and you had connected before, and I'd be keen to understand how you guys first met. But I remember I met you at that, when we were all outside of Bryceland's,
in January, so, right?
Yeah, in January, in the middle of winter, and everyone's kind of hanging out in front of the Bryceland store opening. And I know you've had some kind of pop-ups there, some pop-ups at Clutch Cafe. Kind of how did this London connection get started?
Well, when we first started, we discovered the whole, you know, Clutch, denim, workwear kind of thing. We had always wanted to go to Japan, and we just kind of timed a trip where they were doing the Clutch show in Yokohama, and we were like, well, let's just go do 3 weeks in Tokyo. We can kind of like test the market and maybe make some money and see what happens. So we did, I think we did a couple of days in Tokyo, then we just started working south and did Yokohama. And we met Max from The Real McCoys, and we met Ethan from Bryceland's. And I mean, I didn't know who these guys were. And honestly, like, I could have kind of cared less. It's a pretty peculiar show in that, like, it's industry only, which is kind of hard to test the market when you're kind of, like, just around industry people. It's very insular. So then, yeah, we did Yokohama, and then, you know, we just kind of went on holiday and just kind of got home after 3 weeks. And we're like, well, I guess it didn't catch fire, like no one cares, whatever. And that was kind of it. And then we just kind of started getting phone calls with people wanting to work with us and stuff like that. And that's what I think kind of led into London and working with The Real McCoys, in that we always booked trunk shows in places we wanted to go. So if we, you know, if we were in London or Bangkok or wherever, and we did a trunk show and it flopped, it didn't really matter, because we're someplace we wanted to be, and we're hanging out with people and getting to meet people and stuff like that. And that's just kind of how London's always been for us. I don't know, like, I guess maybe it's just kind of the allure of, you know, Europe in general, but, you know, London's very easy to be there. It's very easy to get anywhere else in Europe also, you know, just, I guess before the Eurostar was super expensive. But I mean, we just like going there. So, you know, even when I was there last couple weeks, hanging out with, you know, Kenji and Ben and everybody, was like, if I don't make any money, it doesn't matter. I get to hang out with my friends in London. Like, that's crazy to me. Like, that idea is not lost on me, that, you know, I grew up in a town of less than 1,000 people, and I get to come over here and hang out with my friends. Like, that's crazy. So just try not to lose sight of that, even if people aren't buying jewelry. So.
Yeah, maybe an interesting related question, just kind of, obviously we've got a particular purview on this community as like kind of like denim heads or whatever, right? But, you know, you're kind of coming into it from a different angle of like a craftsman and a jeweler. How do you sort of, I mean, this is really ambiguous and vague, but like, what's kind of your vibe on this sort of workwear, heritage, denim scene that all these folks seem to be into in some way or another?
Y'all might not like the assessment, so.
All the better.
I don't know. I mean, I appreciate it. I appreciate it. It is what it is, but man, y'all some nerds. Like, y'all like so worried about some of that stuff. It's just wild. And I mean, I grew up on a farm, so, you know, like Red Wings and chore coats, like that wasn't anything cool. You know, that was like, you know, your shit you left at home kind of thing. So it was so weird. Like when we first got into it, we're like, Red Wing heritage, what is this? Why would you want to wear that? Like, that's not, you know, like that's not what we would want to wear, like when we were little or anything. So it's interesting seeing it kind of like, you know, championed. But it's still very far removed from like, you know, that's what I had to wear when I was little because we were broke. And when we had to like slop hogs or do remodeling or whatever, that's kind of what we had to wear. So that's not really what we would want to wear, you know? And I think also I try and look at, you know, especially some of that stuff that Bryce Lane's is doing. I think it's really interesting because there's a lot more utilitarian aspect of it, at least for me. Some of the pieces I have of theirs, as opposed to just the aesthetic value of it. And you know, we've got some stuff from Nine Lives and stuff like that. And I think what they're doing is pretty interesting too, because it is such a mashup. But just the, like, the pure, you know, Japanese purview of, you know, trying to make it as crispy and heavy as possible is just like, man, who is this for? Who's wearing this stuff? Like, I make stuff and I ride motorcycles and I'm not trying to wear any of that stuff. So.
Yeah, I feel like I had one pair of 21-ounce jeans and I was like, I don't know if we're ever going to go that heavy again.
I mean, that stuff, it all looks great once it's broken in, but man, that is a journey, you know, like, and you know, if I'm working too, like it's one of those things where it's got to be functional. I mean, today it's 104 outside. Like, I got, you know, pink Birkenstocks and flip-flops on, like, you know, and basketball shorts. Like, I don't care, you know, like, it might not be romantic, but it's kind of one of those things where it's like, I think a lot of times, you know, the function may get lost in it, and it's a little bit more about the aesthetic or how crispy mine is compared to yours kind of thing, so.
I think also, I guess, the climate dictates what you're going to be wearing quite a lot, and I'm sure if, you know, a lot of people who are into denim were living in somewhere, you know, like Lockhart, they probably wouldn't be wearing that all year round anyway.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah. And it's just a lifestyle too, you know, like what you do and stuff like that. I mean, when we were just over there, we were out in Cornwall for a couple of days, and I got one of the Bryce Lands anoraks, and I like wore it the whole time. And then since we got back here, it will probably not come out until next time I'm back in England kind of thing. So it's wild though, you know, and especially for us, since we travel so much, it's like you have to have like, not only like winter Texas clothes, but you have to have winter Europe clothes too. And I'm not complaining. I mean, it's a good problem to have, but it's always just kind of like a little bit of a mind fuck, so.
Well, one of the interesting things, which kind of feeds back into David's question, you've kind of been embraced by the workwear crowd, but also I think you've had a lot of people embrace you in the kind of the tailoring side as well. Is that due to kind of your relationship with Bryceland, would you say, or is that just something?
I don't know, man. Honestly, I think the thing is I think we've filled a hole that we didn't know existed. I think we were lucky enough that, I mean, RRL kind of championed this point of view, and, you know, the workwear, military, you know, like heritage kind of point of view. And we didn't really know that we were filling a hole. And I think we just kind of lucked out getting to work with Ethan and Kenji, because their point of view is really, really kind of wild, too. It's kind of all over the place. But I mean, they're the ones that hooked us up with the rake. So I would assume that's kind of how we got to kind of go that more like suiting, tailoring kind of vibe. But I mean, I love that stuff too. I think it's just one of those things too, to where like, there's not a lot of like jewelry for men out there kind of thing that isn't just like a big dumb skull ring that's super polished or something like that. You know, like we get messages all the time that are like, is this a men's ring? And it's like, well, is it? Like, you know, how long's a piece of string kind of thing? And I mean, we just try and make what we make. And if it fits, you know, a vibe or a point of view, then great. And if it doesn't, then great. I think that what we do fits pretty easily into denim and leather and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's a little bit trickier in the whole, you know, suiting and tailoring, but it is interesting to see how some of those cats can kind of make that stuff work too. And I think as a guy, there's not really a lot out there in general. Like once you get your, you know, your couple jackets, your couple boots, your couple jeans, like what is there out there? You're either going to be a hat guy or you're not going to be a hat guy. So that's a lane you got to kind of pick, you know, and that's a whole nother thing, you know. But then after that, it's like, well, what can you do if you have some extra income and you want to mess around with your style? There's not a lot, you know, and there's even cats that I've talked to that are just like, I don't wear jewelry. And I'm like, well, you don't wear jewelry till you wear jewelry. Like try it, you know, who knows? Like maybe you're going to be fisted up with jewelry or maybe you're never going to wear it. Like, I think as a guy, like we're just not really given a lot of permission to play around with clothes. So it's kind of almost like we have to give each other permission and just be like, try it. Who cares? Like, it's just clothes. Like, what's it matter? And I mean, we have people come in, especially the trunk shows all the time. And they're like kind of standing in the back with their friend. And they're just like, I'm just looking. I'm just like, try it on. Who cares? You're here. We're here. Like, who cares? Try it on. We'll write down your size. If you buy, cool. If you don't, cool. Like, I don't care. You know, and I think there's just some of that where you just have to like give permission to people to kind of like play around and try things and not, you know, shame people or pick on them or anything, which obviously the community isn't going to do that so much as, you know, their dumb jock friend probably. So
that actually brings up a really interesting insight, actually two insights. The first one is around kind of big dumb friends. So like I was at an Austin FC match about a month ago, and I had like a lime green, what you guys call fanny pack over here, they call bum bag. Mm. And like the dude behind me in the queue to buy my beer is like unzipping it and playing with it, because he obviously thought it was weird that like I've got a fanny pack around me. And I'm like, dude, it's like I'm carrying my shit. Like, what are you doing?
Dude, and like that's weird that a random dude would just, that's so wild. Like,
well, for me, I feel like that's kind of something I would totally expect, like when I was like in high school in Texas, to like have something like that happen. So I'm like, yeah. As a 41-year-old dude, I'm like, I don't think that would happen in the UK. But that's just a small aside. But the more interesting thing, I think, is you touched on something really interesting around the kind of, well, you and Ilya both, around the kind of tailoring and, you know, wearing your jewelry. And that's it. I guess kind of like in the early 2010s, late 2005 to 2010, whatever, when like Inventory magazine was first coming out and like A Continuous Lean was just getting started, and that whole kind of like hashtag menswear boom happened at that time. There was like a formula, right? So it's like everyone wears a Red Wing boot and you wear this particular selvage jeans and you wear like this particular Buffalo check flannel, et cetera, et cetera. And it kind of like everyone jumped on board with that exact style. And at some point, everyone's like, hashtag menswear is dead. It kind of ran its course. But interestingly now, I think you've kind of hit this nail on the head, that there's actually a really even more interesting style movement going on right now, where folks are kind of making up their own looks that are completely unique. You know, so crossing over tailoring with jewelry, workwear with, I don't know, streetwear, or whatever, this kind of idea of like you can kind of invent what you want now and build your own style. And so maybe that's actually like a really cool time to be getting into this stuff, when you can kind of do what you want with it.
Oh, definitely. And I think a lot of that stuff too is like, you know, you wouldn't think to wear X, Y, and Z until you see somebody else put it together. And then you're like, oh, I think I might have those pieces. Like, I'm going to give it a shot. Like, what's it matter? It's just clothes. Like, you shouldn't feel like, you know, you need permission from anything to do anything else, you know. So it's like, you want to wear a neon green fanny pack, wear it. Like, who gives, like who cares, you know? Like, it's so wild. Like, I mean, I even hear, I talked to people in London this last weekend that were like, oh, I just couldn't do that. I'm just like, what? Like, this is crazy. Like, you're a grown man, do whatever you want. Like, who gives a shit? Like, and then also it's the idea of like, thinking that somebody else is going to care. Like, so it's kind of like this self-imposed restriction.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that. There's like, and the thing is, like, most people really don't care about you in general.
Exactly.
So you just have to do you, and yeah, I think that's always the most liberating thing I think you can do.
Oh, absolutely. And we're all going to look back on photos from a couple of years ago and be like, oh, shit, what the fuck was I thinking? You know, why didn't anyone call me out on that? But it's just like, who cares? Like, I mean, I hope that no one's looking back on their high school photos and they're like, oh, I was cool as shit, you know, like.
If they were, they probably like peaked at 25, you know, yeah. Like married kids and like life's kind of done at that point. It's all downhill from there.
Yeah, they got tons of affliction shirts they're still rocking probably.
Well, I guess maybe kind of looking forward a bit. I mean, where do you see the future being going for Red Rabbit? Like new projects, new designs, new, like, I mean, where do you want to take things?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, we're just stoked that people want the stuff in general. I mean, it's still not lost on us that, like, we're shipping all over the place. It's still crazy to us to kind of like process this. And I mean, towards the end of the year, we're going and doing our first trunk show in Bangkok, you know, and that's not, it's just something that was never ever on the radar until it is, kind of thing. So, I mean, it's super cliche, but it's like, man, we're just taking like day by day and, you know, trying to kind of plan everything out. And it's kind of like, you know, the next cool piece is the next one, kind of thing. We're really just trying to do what we do and not be like, oh, we need to scale and we need to do this and we need to do that. And those talks that we have had, you know, literally we've been like, I don't know if this is a scalable business. I think we really just need to stay the course. And, you know, if inspiration strikes, it strikes. If it doesn't, it doesn't, you know, like stop trying to make things what they're not. And we're just trying to make cool jewelry and hang out for the most part. I've just seen so many brands that kind of like, They're so worried about the next thing that they get so far away from, you know, what they started as. And it's kind of one of those like, they were cool until, you know, kind of things. So, I mean, hopefully, you know, we're not getting too far away from that. But we've kind of really just stuck to the whole idea of like, if we like it, we'll make it. And if not, we won't, kind of thing. So kind of goes back to there's no real plan. There's no real like quarterly outline we sit down and go by and just like, oh, this would be cool if we could make this, like, so
yeah, it's cool. It's an envious place to be where you can sort of, you know, shape the destiny of your brand, do what you want, make what you want to make, and you don't have to worry about, you know, changing things up for the next season's collection or
whatever. Yeah, we've done Pity a couple of times, and that just seems like it's just a whole mess to get wrapped up in that whole like fashion trends kind of thing, you know. You know, we do what we do, and that's it, kind of thing. And you know, I mean, we definitely will keep an eye on things, you know. But I think a lot of times, like we'll look for inspiration or trends in places that not anyone else would look at them. So. If then, you know, it gets mashed up with, if it works in the salad of what we do and something else comes out, then it still at least comes out with our point of view. So it's not as forced, you know. And I mean, we still kind of like feeling it out and seeing what happens and lean this way for a minute and lean that way for a minute and, you know, just kind of go with the flow and don't stress out on it too much.
That's pretty cool. Well, Ilya, Tom, any other questions you guys want to add in?
Yeah, if I can butt in. What piece do you personally have, like, find the most, should have thought this through a little bit more, you know, so. What piece are you most satisfied that you've made in terms of like technical skill and kind of silverware making, if that makes sense.
Like, it's kind of hard because there's pieces that stick around for a while and then we have to pay the mortgage and then they get put up for sale. It's weird because it's one of those things where it's not so much when it gets done how, you know, light shines down from heaven and it's like, this is amazing, the technical prowess of it. It's kind of more so that piece that you're in it for 2 days and you don't look at the clock, that you don't jump on Instagram and zone out. It's kind of those pieces that are kind of a little bit more, you know, tugging at the heartstrings because you are in it. You know, whether it's this big, crazy, amazing, heavy, you know, $1,500 bracelet, or it's this weird little technical ring that you were trying to mimic this Victorian ring, but in your point of view, and, you know, you just sell it for $100. So it's weird because it's very much one of those, like, sometimes it's a journey and not the destination. Because you're like, I want to see if I can make this. And then once you make it, you're kind of like, oh, well, yeah, I guess I can do that. So, you know, kind of sometimes once it comes off the bench, then the wind is knocked out of the sails. It's more so about the dance than anything else. I think for the most part, there's only like two bracelets that have stuck around that haven't been sold off. One of them was the first one that I made with my mentor. And then the other one just has a really nice stone. So
maybe a related but slightly different question. Like, let's say someone wants to get into your brand and they're like I've pulled up the website just to kind of do a bit of a scan. They're like, man, I really dig Red Rabbit's work. Where should I jump in? Like, what products would you point people to for kind of an entry point to kind of like, where would you steer someone for like a first piece?
It's hard because I only recently just started wearing necklaces. So honestly, like for years and years, I tried necklaces and I was like, I want to wear necklaces so bad. And I just couldn't. And I finally had to just be like, I'm going to do it, whatever. And then also, you know, my wife was like, we can sell necklaces. So we need to do that. But I mean, necklaces are easy because they're not as committal as like a ring. Also pins are really easy, you know, for summer or winter, for suiting or, you know, jackets or hats. So I think for, you know, dip your toe in the water kind of thing, pieces like that are good. They're relatively low price points. They're not as committal. And you can kind of like see if it's your jam or not, whether it's jewelry or whether it's our jewelry or not. And then if you don't like it, you just stick it on a hat or a jacket or give it away as a gift kind of thing. I think it's one of those things. We've had a handful of people that'll follow the Instagram for years and they'll be like, oh, I screenshotted this and that and this and that. And it's all these big, crazy pieces. And I'm like, yeah, they look great, but you don't normally wear rings or you work with your hands. Like, you probably don't want to grab that. Like, you might not even wear rings or you might not even wear bracelets. So I just try something simple. Just because it's crazy or it looks good online, you know, when it's on our phone 2 inches by 2 inches, might not look the best or the scale may not be the best for you or what you wear.
One thing that just kind of popped to my mind, which is maybe a bit silly or maybe not, I don't know, but you mentioned how kind of people look at the stone as kind of like the focal point of the piece and ignore the silver work. Maybe you could do a series where you do rings that would normally hold a piece of stone, but put a really high shiny ass piece of silver, as you called it, in the silver ring. So it's like taking the piss out of a big stone.
From time to time, I'll do all silver pieces. But one of our Japanese customers, like I think we must have sent him a batch or asked him his opinion on him, and he goes, Red Rabbit has stones. He's like, Red Rabbit jewelry has stones. Customers know that that's what you do. Like, and I was just like, damn, man, like you just cut right to the quick. Like, you're just like solidified the whole model down to like, motherfucker, you ain't selling shit unless it's got stones on it. It's like, damn. So, I mean, it's one of those things to where it's like, you know, for the most part, our stuff generally will have stones because it's really easy to like find a cool stone and then work off of it. But sometimes it doesn't need it, you know, or sometimes also it's just cool to make a piece as like a crazy stamp pattern. And then when somebody like, you know, gravitates towards it, you're like, right, it didn't need a stone. Like, look at this thing and this thing. And then you can geek out like how you guys talk about like stitch patterns and stuff. So.
That's actually an interesting topic. There's probably, maybe there's a wealth of already really interesting content out there, but maybe either like a men's file issue or someone somewhere might want to shed some more light on kind of the nuance of the silver working and the stamping, because it sounds like there's a lot of nuance and craft and kind of minutia there that, like, almost like when someone showed you a selvage loom to say, like, this is why this kind of denim's better, you know, kind of like teaching customers that sort of like opening them into the knowledge of silver work, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's probably just not so many people that actually care about it, though, so.
But at one point, I mean, no one cared about selvage, right? Except for a few people.
Yeah, I guess, especially that. So that's the thing. It's like, especially with silver work, like, you know, it's a difference between with jeans. Then I guess it'd be the difference between, you know, making your own denim or going to wherever and buying the denim. So it's the same thing. It's like with silver, like we can make our own bars, or I can just hop online and order stuff pre-made too. So it kind of just depends, you know, but then also the customer has to be able to understand that process to be able to appreciate it and understand why it's substantially more. And luckily, like, you know, the Japanese market in every craft, they understand that. So like they'll specifically ask the process of it. And even if it's not the process they like, but they love the piece, they won't buy it because they appreciate the process more than the piece almost. So it's interesting, but also, like, you know, here in the States, people are going to be like, I don't get why these two things look exactly the same and one substantially more. And it's like, well, let me sit here and give you an education on why. And they're just like, yeah, this one's still cheaper. And I'm just like, get that one then. I don't care, you know. So, but some of it's just like, you just want to know how to do it and then see if you can do it kind of thing. So.
Very cool. Yeah, it's interesting. Every time I scroll through your website, I'm finding more interesting minutia. Because there's a lot of like layers and detail and like nuance to your work. Like I'm sort of catching a detail on the side of a ring here, or like, you know, looking at the dice that can be like your valve caps, and even just kind of the choice and what gets printed on the dice. And there's a lot of layers to unpick, and definitely feels like a brand where you can kind of like an onion, just kind of keep peeling back the layers and you know, get more into the minutia of it. It's really cool.
Thanks. We appreciate it. I mean, we just try and do what we like. And, you know, like with the dice specifically, like I really like tangible things, especially like when in our marketing, we don't do a lot of like Facebook ads or anything like that. I'm like, well, I would rather do $300 in stickers and then just give them away. Like I like having things that are tangible. So with the dice, we did a bunch of dice and kind of went crazy. I like just having them, they're tangible. But then also we're like, well, it makes sense. Like we ride motorcycles and have old cars. So we're like, well, we may as well see if we can do some of that. So it's like everything that we've done, we've just tried to make it like very organic, have it work within the brand. So it's kind of like, we're working on a new project right now, and it's hard because we're so in the tunnel of Red Rabbit that when we're trying to develop this other project, it's hard to put a completely different point of view on it and not just kind of keep coming back to center kind of thing. But I think it's primarily because Red Rabbit was so natural and so organic and just kind of happened and then kind of flowed this way and that way. And that's kind of our natural workflow. So when we're working on this other thing, it's not necessarily our lane, but we're trying to get educated on it. So we're like, well, we can't just do what we did before because it wouldn't work. The point of view doesn't work. We need to get educated and have a point of view in that world also. So I'm glad that, you know, that you like the point of view of Red Rabbit, and it actually comes across like relatively organized because it's not. So.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah, I like it. It's something where I didn't immediately kind of like I'm not historically like into vintage jewelry per se, but like I'm kind of, because I know Ilya picked up a piece from you, a bracelet, and I know Tom's is also a big fan of jewelry from the period. So I'm kind of like I'm learning. I'm on the beginning of the journey, whereas these guys are already at the destination.
Well, next time we'll be in London, you'll be coming by getting all filled up then.
Awesome. Well, you might be visiting in Lockhart.
Oh yeah, I guess you're gonna be here in a minute.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, hopefully maybe in a couple months. Well, visiting in the meantime, but yeah, hopefully properly there in a couple months.
Well, maybe you can mule back some of the jewelry to London for us.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to.
Yeah, dude, once we announced that we were going to be there a couple weeks ago, man, we had so many orders that were like, can I pick it up? Can I pick it up in Chilton Street? Can I pick it up? And we're like, yeah, no problem. And they're just like, boom, no problem. Order. It was crazy. Y'all's VATs, man, we were telling people, we were like, yeah, it's worth it for you guys just to buy here just so you can avoid shipping and avoid VATs. So.
Yeah, I know there's that whole new something or other partnership between Biden and Sunak, and I'm hoping it might make the VAT situation a little bit less painful. It's like a cross-Atlantic trade partnership, something or other.
Okay.
Because I know at one point taxes were a bit rough importing stuff into the States, and Obama was like, I'm going to raise the bar so that anything under $800 is duty-free import, VAT-free import into the States, and like that was definitely a game changer. So maybe they'll make it the situation a bit better going this direction.
Yeah, we need the same. For sure.
I mean, if it's political, I wouldn't hold your breath on it, you know.
So. That's the truth.
Yeah, not with Rishi as well.
Cool. Well, I guess a big thank you, Mike. I appreciate you jumping on to chat with us. It's awesome to finally connect. I know we talked about this ages ago when you're in London. So big thanks. And big thank you, Ilya, for trying to kind of make sure that we were able to get this facilitated and organized. So thank you as well.
I don't think I did that much apart from trying to prod, you know, and to move it along. But no, thank you. Thank you, Mike. I really appreciate your time.
For sure. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, it was good. It was good to see you back in London. I hope you had a great trip.
Yeah, the weather was nice. So. Yeah.
I think you locked out. Yeah.
The rain's back again.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, yeah, we'll have to get a pint next time you're in town, this side of the pond, and maybe meet up for some barbecue at some point across the pond.
Yeah, definitely. Hit me up when you're here.
Cool. Awesome.
All right. Later, y'all.
All right. Thanks, guys. Take it easy.
Nice.
Yeah. Bye. Bye-bye.